we explore the big stories from Little America. The anthology series is one of the first offerings from the Apple TV Plus streaming service. Each episode of Little America gives us an intimate look at a different immigrant's experience here in the United States. Josh Behrman is an executive producer for the series. He's also a reporter and the co-founder of the website Epic Magazine. Epic Magazine reported the initial series of stories that served as the inspiration for the TV show.
The idea originally was, let's just tell immigrant stories as regular stories. And Lee Eisenberg is a well-known writer and showrunner in film and TV. And I know him socially, and he came to me. This was just after the election. I think it was around the inauguration, actually, and said he was interested in developing something around immigrants. His father's an immigrant, and he'd been thinking about their relationships to America and how they differ from one another. And then, of course, the election happened, and so I think it really was around the inauguration. It's like the reality of the new political era was setting in, and that's when he called and he said, "Do you want to do something like this?" And I said, "Sure." That seemed like a very valuable use of, you know, our storytelling abilities. So I sent a lot of researchers and writers and went out and collected as many different stories as we could. I mean, it was very time consuming. As you know, we probably started with 100 plus leads and then did maybe like 75 interviews or something, and then narrowed it down from there to 40 or so people that we really talked to a lot. And then eventually we published 15 stories when we kind of polished it all up and down to a core group. And we had stories from Idaho and Kansas and Florida and Ohio and all these different places, Texas. And even as they were kind of coming together, we were getting a sense of, oh, the shape of this show is going to work as an anthology where you can kind of each story is a different facet, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of this mosaic portrait. So we wanted stories that were widely representative, people from different parts of the world living in different parts of the country, people who were here as refugees or to study, you know, in school.
Good afternoon, Professor Robbins. I filled my TA application weeks ago. When do we hear?
The application window hasn't closed yet.
I see. Well, to refresh your memory, I'm the best in class. I have the most need and the money we're helping to get back home this summer.
I'm trying to hire a student who can teach in my stead.
That is me.
You're also extremely pushy.
How am I pushy?
Well, take, for example, how you're going about trying to get this job. The truth is, you make people a little uncomfortable. And for someone who wants to join the faculty, you don't seem to try very hard to fit in. Now, if you'll excuse me.
People who have just been arrived, or people who have been here for, you know, decades, people who succeeded here and people who maybe didn't succeed to the desire they thought. And so as the producers and writers are looking at them, we were able to see the half hour of television more clearly and see what the adaptation possibilities are. And so they kind of just sort of emerged out of the 15 as the subgroup somewhat naturally.
Yeah. And given the subject matter of these stories, the stories in Little America, they naturally come up against U.S. immigration policies, which are very controversial these days. How did these policies influence the way you adapted these real stories into episodes?
Well, emotionally and story-wise, you know, the current American politics did not really influence explicitly what we were doing, because none of the episodes are sort of taking on immigration directly. They are indirectly. They're not meant to be overtly political, but they're political by virtue of just sort of telling stories from the lives of immigrants and portraying them as people with the same struggles as everybody else, and trying to sort of break the notion of a narrative where there, you know, there's an othering of people coming from somewhere, or a simplification of, you know, all immigrants are refugees. So there was kind of a subtextual politics there, but didn't tackle immigration directly, other than to sort of make the general humanist kind of obvious point of everybody's the same. When people come here, they have the same, you know, hopes and dreams or fears and frailties that we do, there's no they or we anyhow, really. So that said, there was actually a production issue relating to current immigration law, which was kind of a supreme irony, which is we have an episode that is about a Syrian guy who's gay, discovered he was gay when he was young, was caught by his family with a man, and in that part of the world, that can be very dangerous. His family actually was maybe trying to kill him, definitely inflicting bodily harm on him, so he fled. And he eventually gets to Jordan, and then he winds up, and he applies for asylum in the United States, and he gets to Idaho. And there he is sort of finally able to be who he wants to be.
Girl, you look like you just fled your homeland. Take a shower, come on, we're going out.
The end of the episode is sort of the end of the original story as he told it also, where it's kind of his flight. It's one of the stories that's actually sort of the story, the big kind of like immigration story of how I got here. Most of them are not like that. But his winds up with him going into his first gay bar and seeing the sort of expression of sexual identity unfettered, and he can't believe it. And then he actually met the guy that he is now married to. And so that's, you know, a very emotional and sort of inspiring story, and says some very nice things about what America represents. However, currently, the travel ban makes it so that somebody from Syria cannot come here, and many other countries. And so a lot of the actors that we wanted to use for the episode don't live in the United States. They're in London or other places, Canada. And so they couldn't come into the country. And so here we are telling a story about how America, like, you know, opens its doors, lets people who have to flee for their lives so they can be themselves. And we couldn't actually shoot that episode in America anymore. We had to move production to Canada. We shot it in Montreal.
Which episode was this?
That episode is called The Sun. It's number 8. It's the final episode. It's sort of the capper of the series.
Yeah, that's interesting, the lengths you had to go to and how that provided a real kind of editorial comment on the situation.
Yeah, it was not lost on everybody putting this production together. And we thought, oh, this is all the more reason to make the show.
The first episode is called The Manager. Can you tell us a bit about this episode?
Sure. And this is sort of a melancholy story, which is this boy, Kabir, in the episode Kunal in real life. His family's from India, and they run a small motel together. And the parents have to go back to India to deal with visa immigration stuff. And it's one of those things where they're, we got to go back to do the paperwork. But then the paperwork took 10 years.
It's a bureaucratic issue.
But it's your fault this happened. You lack prospicience. That means foresight.
And these things take time.
So he was left there to run the hotel at, 13 years old. So he's like this kind of, and he's a precocious kid who's very smart. He was like competed in the state and national spelling bee. So he's this kid with real promise, and he's going to school and also the manager of this motel.
I run an economy value in Alfred 22. We're the third ranked motel in Green River, according to TripAdvisor, and I like to keep it that way. I don't have time for spelling bees.
But then it becomes a little bit of a different story when you see him age over time and you realize as a teenager that because his parents were gone and he had to be an adult for himself, he didn't get to have the childhood and the teenage years and the youth that he had hoped for. And so it's a sad moment when you see him realize that. And this is true to life. And then his parents eventually do come back, and of course he's thrilled. But then there's the weird reality that they haven't been together in all this time, and so he hasn't grown up with them, so they don't know each other anymore, right? So there's this melancholy moment at the end where they realize, like, they don't know how to relate to each other.
Yeah, it's a very powerful episode, and as you mentioned, the parents are away. They're back in India. It takes 10 years to get the paperwork accepted so that they can return to the States. Do you have a favorite scene in this episode?
I feel like the very, very end is just among the most powerful moments in all of the series, because the emotional complexity is coming through there, and it's not really what you expect, where they're together, but they don't really know how to be together anymore, and he feels better, but is aware of the loss. And the parents are glad to be home, but know that something has changed.
Beta, how's your life?
You have a good life?
It's fine. How are you?
But you can tell by the way he says it and just the whole facial expression that he's not fully happy, and he shouldn't be because, as you said, mm-hmm. he exhibited a lot of promise. He was spelling bees, yeah. and there's this great storyline at the beginning about how his dad says if he can memorize all the words in Webster's dictionary by the time he's 16, he'll get a Trans Am. So it's very nuanced and a very powerful episode. What kind of feedback have you received from people after they've seen the episode based on their personal life story about the way they were portrayed? What kinds of things do they say?
In general, people have really responded. I mean, this original subjects who have seen the episodes. And in a couple cases, we've been there together when they were first screened.
Oh, that must be an interesting experience.
Yes. So I watched one of the episodes the episode is called Marisol, which is, I think, number 2.
Yes.
And the subject's name is Reina originally. And so we kind of got a screening together and watched it. She had her fiance there. It was kind of delightful to watch her watching it. She was sort of freaked out at first, like, oh, I'm going to hide my face and be embarrassed mostly, right? You know?
Yeah.
And she was instead delighted. She had a big smile on her face. And then afterwards, she was sort of stunned for a little bit and trying to process it and was overwhelmed. And then, you know, and then sort of the dam broke and she talked about how much she loved it and just how valuable she thought it was. Mm. And so that was very gratifying to see.
Yeah, that's the second episode, The Jaguar, right? In which she becomes, becomes really good at squash and becomes like a champion, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think these stories would still work as fiction, but it seems like that they're more powerful and more effective because they're based on true stories. What do you think?
I do think that. I find that to be the case with the projects that we work on in general. I also, one of my stories was adapted into the film Argo.
Yeah.
And I think often, in some way, you get more liberty as a storyteller in adaptation when it's coming from a true story, because if you invented the story of Argo, for example, then it would have seemed ridiculous. Oh, they used a movie and fake science fiction movie to smuggle out diplomats. You'd be like, no, I'm not buying it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, same with some of these episodes. Like, you know, it's a pretty dramatic story, shoddy story. Or even Reina's story. An undocumented kid becomes a squash champion and then now is the analyst at Goldman Sachs, you know, based on the fact that she got her life together and got purpose from squash, and the eccentric squash coach who's sort of a weirdo but guides her. Like, those things would read as false, right?
Yeah.
If they were invented, but because they're real, you can connect to them in a different way.
Good. Very good.
Really?
No, you were bad. But inside of you, there is a jaguar.
Okay.
In the words of the great basketball player, Kevin Garnett, a.k.a. KG, you cannot teach the beast. It is either in you or it is not. You cannot go to the store and buy a six-pack of beast.
I wonder, it would be interesting to do an experiment if psychologists have done this. If you didn't know that it was a true story, would it still have that same impact on you? Or is there something about the way our brains are wired and empathy and things that, because we know it's true, that we're more invested in it? I wonder.
That is a really good question. Very interesting potential psychological study. I wonder, because like I think about the human storytelling antenna, you know, in relationship to true stories and fictionalized stories all the time, and I hadn't quite thought of it that way. I would love to see somebody get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that and find out if anyone has. But you mentioned Argo, and when you were working on this story, did you ever think it would end up on the big screen and become the big film that it was, 2012 film,
came out
with Affleck, and didn't it win Best Picture that year?
It did. It won Best Picture. It won the Globes. It won the BAFTAs. It won all the Guild Awards. It was sort of astonishing. No, I did not expect that.
So
I thought, it's pretty good. It'll be, you know, like, they know what they're doing. And, you know, it came out and sort of right out of the gate felt like something different. It feels a little bit similar here, where it's very hard to get anything actually made, much less make it good. I was like, this is pretty good. People will like it. But the reception has been much greater than I imagined, and the full-throated enthusiasm. And it feels like, oh, there's something special going on here, in a way that we hadn't even anticipated.
Yeah. Did you, if you don't mind my asking, did you get an Oscar? yourself.
I did not get there. No, there is no Oscar for being the source material.
Well, we got to change that.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
And retroactively. There isn't.
I mean, Chris Terrio, the writer, screenwriter who adapted it, did get an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. But I don't get one, unfortunately. Although, even though my name is on his Oscar, because it says, like, best, you know, it's like,
oh, it's on his,
for Argo, based on the story by Bubba, it's like a very elaborate credit that like was read, you know, at the Oscars on stage, which was sort of to the delight of my parents.
Of course.
But no, I did not get my own statue.
Mm. Well, there's still time, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Little America has already been renewed for a second season. Is there anything that you'd like to do differently during the second season in terms of the kind of storytelling?
Yes, I think we are. I mean, where the writer's room is ongoing right now. In fact, I stepped out in order to come and sit down with you. And many of the writers from last season are back and some new ones, and everybody's sitting around looking at all the collection of stories that we have to figure out what's in season two. And I think what's been interesting to us is, you know, we have a pretty good range of stories in the first season, mm-hmm. and there's some tonal range too, you know, and just like the directorial tone of the episodes varying, mm-hmm. you know, from one to the other. But I think we might even try to stake out more territory and experiment a little bit more in a couple places, you know, widen the range a little bit so that it's not just sort of eight more really good episodes like last time. They're taking sort of different risks.
Josh Behrman is one of the executive producers of Little America, which streams on Apple TV+. Find out more about Josh and the show at wpr.org/beta.
I think the greatest gift that Quentin gave me that week was he just let me be. A couple of rehearsals before we started shooting, he said, look, it's all on you.
Mike Moe tells us about his journey from Wanakee, Wisconsin to Hollywood, California to portray the iconic actor and martial artist Bruce Lee in the Quentin Tarantino movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. His story is coming up next. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.